targeting long-term affordability at Burbank Apartments. This campaign is organized by the Burbank Apartments Tenant Association and Fenway Community Development Corporation. Burbank Apartments is a set of East Fenway buildings with 173 affordable units, which have long been affordable to low-income and working families. However, the owners want to opt out of federal subsidy programs and convert the units to market rate at the end of March. The owners' decision affects not only current tenants, but also potential Fenway residents. Thousands of people will no longer be able to afford to live in this neighborhood that has access to economic, educational, transit, and cultural resources. People of color will be disproportionately affected. But tenants and their neighbors are fighting back. They do need your help, though. Again, that's this Monday at 2:45 p.m. A march will begin at Edgar Lee Road Playground, followed by a rally at 3:30 p.m. and a hearing at 4 p.m. at Susan Bayless Assisted Living Community at 352 Mass Ave at St. Botolph Street, across the street from the Mass Ave Orange Line T-Stop. If you can't attend, you can also help by calling the building owners to demand that they preserve long-term affordability. For more information, visit fenwaycdc.org.
And I'm afraid that we have run out of time once again. Thank you, Mark. The views and opinions expressed on this program have been those of the participants and not necessarily the staff and management of WMBR, the Technology Broadcasting Corporation, or MIT. Thank you for joining us on What's Left. We shall be back next week. Now stay tuned for music for human beings coming up after one or two brief messages. This is WMBR in Cambridge.
Do you want to change the world? Come to the National Conference for Media Reform at Boston Seaport World Trade Center and join many others who care about corporate media control, quality news reporting, independent music, and online freedom and innovation. To register, go to freepress.net, the National Conference for Media Reform. Change the media, change the world.
The MIT Folk Dance Club presents International Dance on Sundays from 8 until 11 p.m. It's free for MIT and Wellesley students, with donations accepted from others. On Tuesdays, there's contra dancing with live music and a caller. No partner or experience is necessary. It's also free for MIT students, with a small donation accepted from others. On Wednesdays, it's Israeli dancing. From 7 to 8 o'clock, the family dancing, and the regular session follows from 8 until 11 p.m. Enter Lobby 13 at the rear of 105 Massachusetts Avenue or via 77 Massachusetts Avenue. The MIT Folk Dance Club. Regular teaching and requests. 617-253-FOLK or fdc-request@mit.edu. You're listening to WMBR Cambridge, Boston.
مرحباً. مرحباً في Music for Human. I am الدكتور جالس السكران. And I am here for you. Like a pretzel, and I am thirsty. We welcome tonight Erno. Erno, marhaban.
Hello, doctor. My spirit permeates this room, and I feel uplifted that is once again the time for our discussion.
Erno, I too am uplifted.
I feel raised upon a wind, blowing through the air, free as a bird. During this hour, my spirit reaches out to the world, and I will trade it for nothing.
Spirit reaching. It is an elegant thing. It makes me wonder if the spirits are durable. Because, like many things, the body deteriorates and is destroyed.
Isn't that the ultimate question, though? I also wonder that even if our bodies are alive, is it perhaps possible for our spirits to reach out to the world from our bodies, to connect with those around us and influence the world like a ghost taken away from its own body, but only for a temporary time? Sometimes I feel like my spirit reaches out to the world in this way, as a living ghost.
In a way, it does. Here we are moving. We are... we are vibrating everything. Here to vibrate with us is Zoro, the numerologist. Zoro, marhaban.
Thank you for having me on the show again, Doctor. And thank you, as always, to all the listeners out there.
Zoro, it is only our pleasure to have you.
I like this image of the soaring of the spirit. It is nicely in line, I think, with the apparatus of the radio transmitting the signal across space. And this is so with our spirit as well, I think, is a metaphor.
Indeed. Perhaps it is not just the energy beams that radiate from the tower of WMBR. Perhaps it is our spirits themselves reaching out to our audience and connecting with them. And through the phone lines, their spirits reach back and touch ours. It is a beautiful dance of mind and soul. I find this music very uplifting. But yet I feel an ominous presence.
Thank you.
I wonder if perhaps the ghost possibility for our spirit is perhaps not that far or that out of the question. I have heard stories from colleagues I know who are in the physical disciplines that there are particles that exist that pass through other particles like ghosts. I believe, I don't remember the name off the top of my head, but they are indeed physical entities that are able to freely pass through my body and the earth. If physical entities to do that can do that, what is to say our spirits cannot pass through and into the spirit of another person and connect with them?
Indeed, there is a lot of evidence that this sort of interaction is quite common. I recall being shown the story of a man who accidentally discovered his soul wandering. It was wandering. He was, of course, in his room, not moving, stationary. But his soul was driving on the highway, and the soul, it reached Maryland, where he knew a friend was staying, and his soul drove up, and his friend was unaware that his soul was present.
Did he view this as a remote viewing type experience? That is what I imagine as you describe this story to me, Doctor.
No, I believe that there was a multiple experience, that his experience was as of a witness to the event, also an experience from the room seeing nothing, and also an experience from within the spirit traveling and spying. Eventually, his friend became aware of the presence, but only mildly, sort of a subconscious disturbance. So he reached out spiritually and pinched her in the belly. Not very hard, he thought. Many weeks later, he mentioned this to her, you know, not really being certain that the experience had taken place in spite of the seeming reality. He mentioned it to her jokingly, and she said, "That was you?" And she lifted up her shirt, and there was an enormous bruise where she had been pinched clearly by his spirit, it was thought.
That is quite interesting. I'm curious, what was the destination? Is there a particular reason why one friend should have his spirit to connect with this other friend in particular? Or perhaps it was simply seeking accompaniment?
It's difficult to say these sorts of experiences, how it is exactly that his spirit was driving or traveling along a road in reality, or why it would particularly be drawn to this other person. But it remains a fascinating piece of anecdotal evidence. I tried to have the same person repeat his experience in a controlled setting, but we were never able to reproduce effects. It is perhaps a one-off.
Yes, I think this is a sort of thing which perhaps is quite difficult to do under concentration, and in the Zen sort of sense is more simple if you are relaxed and not too focused.
I feel the presence of children in this music. Perhaps our souls can reach out to the spirits of other beings through our art. Perhaps this is one method we can use to extend the range of our spirit.
I think that is the dream, the implicit dream and desire of every artist, even if it is only to reach his own soul in a future time.
Yes, for how can you know your own soul unless you let it out of your body, unless you let it express itself?
Yes, I think this is precisely the point. Is in your art, you are taking a manifestation of your own inner desires and hopes and goals and your spirit, and you are giving it a physical form. And then you may reflect on it as something which is external to you and consider that it has come from internally.
I, for one, believe my work allows me to let my soul out of its cage and reach out and touch other people. This radio show, obviously, is part of that, but my work with potions and what many people would call New Age medicine, though I do not consider myself a physician, allows me to, through not only the use, but advising other people on the use of potions, it allows me to reach out and touch their soul.
Lowers
inhibitions, if you will.
I really love this image, because a person who is too self-involved, too concerned with one's appearance or one's relationship with other things, these are important, but they may prevent one from being natural, from being expressive. And a lesson that I learned in my lifetime was to allow that there were periods of time in life that I would not be able to exert control, that I may wake up and find myself in another city and not seek an explanation, because it is written. Well, if you would like to change the history of the program, the number is 617-253-8810, and we would love to have our history changed. Caller, marhaban.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Caller, thank you for being on.
I have just a question. You're talking about the soul and reaching out with the spirit. I don't know about this. It's kind of existential and philosophical and metaphysical, but who exactly are we as individual human beings? What's our identity, a personal identity, as far as being an individual creature of creation, of existence, of being?
I think that is a great question, caller. And in fact, it's something I believe we've discussed several times since I have joined the program. Mm. Are we individual beings in a world, sharing a world, or is it in fact one world and we are all aspects of one being, This is something that I question sometimes, because it seems like life is very much interconnected at times. I feel very connected, and other times I feel very isolated. I don't know if if my co-host or the caller's experiences mirror that.
No, I think I agree. There are many facets to which we consider ourselves. And part of the human condition is that we wonder these things. What is our relationship with the others? How do we define that which is not the self? And how do we define that which is part of us?
Yeah, and caller, I would like to add that it seems to be a great theme in the history of life on Earth that originally, you know, I see this issue come up repeatedly when I hear groups of people debate on abortion or on the sanctity of life, which is a term that I've heard a lot. And I think that here we are, and we each of us, there is an instinct to build an individuality and an independence and a separate life. But truly, life does not begin at any moment that is relevant to me, particularly. That at my conception did life begin? At my birth did life begin? At some moment in between or after? The truth is that life began billions of years ago, and we are all manifestations of a single life. And a part of our brain remembers this, that we are associated with others and is determined in one hand to build an individual life, a separate life, but also with the knowledge constantly that we are dependent on others and that we are part of that life.
I want to ask you a thing I ponder myself. At your average waking moment, like right now, do you know who you are, or does anybody really know who they are in the average waking moment between the hours of waking up and going to sleep?
That's quite an interesting question. I think that we only know who we are when we do not question it. And so it is possible that we are assuming who we are when we do not question it. And I think that in the moments when we do not consider who we are, we really are ourselves in the most capacity.
Why don't we bring a second caller in? Join the circle. Stay with us, caller.
All right.
Caller 2, marhaban.
What happens to the fist when you open your hand?
Caller, if this may be also good for everyone, please, if when you call to please step away or turn down the radio. So, caller, I'm sorry, if you could repeat.
When you hold a fist, there...
A fist, you mean one to close the hand?
Yeah, what happens to that when you open your hand?
That is an interesting question. I think it is sort of related to this question of is an object really there when you are not observing it? And it seems the case with many physical things, which it must be there when we do not observe it. But you raise a good point to ask of the fist. Yeah, it is sort of like identity in that... when you consider the fist, it is a concrete object, but if the hand is open, where did the fist go? Well, it is an implication of the abstraction of the thing, I think.
Caller, if you perhaps could elaborate.
Thank you.
Well, I think that when the fist opens up, it becomes an open hand, and it's the opposite of the fist.
It is a separate sort of existence.
But the open hand is opposite of what a fist is. A fist is something you may use for violence. An open hand is one of acceptance and openness.
Yet they are both aspects of the same object, of the same entity. And so if we extrapolate and apply this reasoning to not only our hands, but our bodies, we all have well, I guess what we can call a good side and a bad side. Hmm. And it is these two things that come together to make who we are. So to go back to the caller's question about how do we really know who we are, I don't really know if it's a question you can answer in words, but only a question you could answer in actions. It's what you do that determines who you are.
That is quite poetic. I think that it rings very true. And it brings us to define the fist by its own existence and not by its vanishing.
But I think Erno here is saying that the fist, the identity of the fist, is determined by the actions of the fist.
Or in this case, the hand, for we have the open palm and the fist, both of which are aspects of the much broader entity of the hand.
So I would like to ask, and also, caller, if you would like to share your opinion here, I would be curious that the identity of the person, the being, is determined by the actions. But if the person does not remember, so without a memory, is the identity of the person lost? The caller mentions a person who may wake up, may suddenly gain consciousness and be unaware, be uncertain of his own identity. So is the identity lost with the memory?
Well, people with amnesia don't know who they are. I mean, as far as a medical condition called amnesia, the memories, without memories, past experiences, you don't know who you are. You don't have an identity according to that medical model of the psychiatric model, whatever you want to call it, amnesia.
But so much of the brain maintains memory. There is still muscle memory. There are trained habits and behaviors that remain even in a patient with amnesia. But if these things are lost, or maybe a broader question is the identity or any part of the identity there?
I don't know.
Yes, this is interesting. I actually have an acquaintance who had, upon awaking one day, forgotten every fact about their life. It is a very interesting story to hear. There has been no medical explanation for the occurrence at this time, and it happened quite some time ago, actually, much before I knew this person. But it is a very, very touching story. It very moves you because you must consider it is one thing to question identity as a person, but it is another thing to wake up and not know the concept of identity, not have an identity, and then try and find one. Because I think that as we meditate on the concept here, we are taking into account those things which we use to define ourselves, but if we do not have them, then there is a certain lack of context to many of the things which we try to say now. Imagine that you are to say the identity of the hand has to do if it is a fist or if it is open hand, and then a deer comes up and it asks you what identity it has. It does not make a fist, suddenly there is no comparison.
Didn't René Descartes, the French philosopher and the Enlightenment, say the famous quotation, "I think, therefore I am"? Wasn't it he who said that?
Yes.
So what he was trying to answer the same question: what determines my identity or what my existence? Just the fact of thinking. So maybe what you think, your thoughts, or who you are. I don't know what you think Descartes trying to say in that statement. I think, therefore I am.
I think thought guarantees existence. Another way of saying this is that that a thinking person who is living in an environment, he cannot guarantee the reality that he experiences. At the same time, there is no meaning to any other existence. So I may may actually exist here. I may be a simulated being in another universe and exist only as a model in some grand computer. I may merely be the idea of another consciousness which is greater than I am. But all of these existences for me are equivalent because I cannot distinguish one from the other.
So also the religious, mostly Christian belief that you can be born again, which implies a new identity. I don't know, I mean, Jesus, the great avatar Jesus said, you must be born again. What do you think he was referring to?
Well, I think that there is a distinction between the sort of Christian idea, which is of a single life, but a life that is durable beyond death, and a more, for example, the Hindu belief in reincarnation, which is a genuinely new life, but attached to the same soul. Why don't we bring another... Never mind.
Yes, I think that this idea of being born again, it arises, I think, partially because there is a notion of purity of being which comes from birth. And the significance of the term to be born again is to become of the same purity of your birth. It is not necessarily to... perhaps it is to modify your identity, but it does not erase it. It replaces your responsibility in a sense that you will atone for everything you may possibly do, and start with no sins upon you. If this makes sense.
I think that in the church, some churches, when you're baptized and you're washed and you're born, you're baptized, you receive a new name, a baptismal name. Does that imply a new identity, a new name?
I believe that this whole concept of being born again goes back to what we were originally talking about regarding identity and what it means and the definition. For if you use the definition that a person is defined by the actions and how they live their life, then really all this born again talk, what it means is that you are making a commitment to change your actions and thus change who you are, if that's really how we are defining identity.
That's very good. I'm going to let someone else call in, but thank you for your insights.
Start with us if you like, Connor.
What's that?
You, of course, may stay with us. We have two lines. But in any case, if anyone would like to call, it's 617-253-8810.
I think I'll just retire from the conversation for the night. I'll listen on the radio.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, caller.
But peace be with you.
And with you, caller. I think this is a very interesting idea. Let me ask, back to the example of the fist. The fist, which is held clenched for its entire existence, if it opens and then has no memory of being clenched, will it not already have grown, have patterns in the growth, and find itself having in its existence, in the structure of the bone and of the muscle, naturally that it wishes to return to the fist? So even without neurological memory in the conventional sense, there is a memory there in the material, and a natural return to the habits, the things that have been worn in like deep grooves.
It is an interesting thing to consider. The fist, which is born into a hand, but with no psychic imprint of the existence it led previously.
Another way to ask this is the farmer, if he were to suddenly lose his memory, he would wake up perhaps not knowing that he is a farmer, that the calluses on his hand are from holding various farming implements, or that his muscular structure has developed in a response to this exercise. But if he is placed in a situation where he is expected to farm, certainly his ability, in spite of having no memory, would exceed those of the average person.
Yes, I think actually there is a in popular culture a series about identity which confronts this nature quite directly. The born identity. I believe there is a character which does not remember, but he has these reflexes. So I think that it does implicate a bit of a connection, even though you may not consciously recall many things. That does not mean that there is not a holism to you which is greater than your memory.
I'm beginning to really, as I sit here and we talk, I'm thinking a lot about this concept of identity and interaction, and how our identity is shaped not only by our memory, but how we interact. For even if we lose our memory, those around us remember. So if I one day became a crazed murderer and I murder 40 people, but then I lose my memory, those around me still remember, and I still carry that identity. So I think it's really hard, very difficult, I mean, to say the least, that identity cannot be narrowed down just to an individual. We think of it like an individual concept, but it's like this, you cannot separate it from the whole either.
I think I agree with you. There is much memory which is, in a sense, external.
It's cultural memory, society's memory.
Yes, precisely.
I think it's very strange. We are all, we have this quest for individual identity, yet is completely and utterly defined by how we interact with others. So this quest for individuality just leads us straight back to the connected single oneness of life. It's almost like you cannot say that life is either one life or many. It's both at the same time. It is incredible.
So perhaps I think that we are coming a bit to the conclusion that there is not such thing as a separate identity from the universe. You may not say that there is you and there is an external universe. Is this so?
I do not think that one's identity can be separated from the environment they are in and those they interact with. Regardless of memory, you may not remember who you are, but at one point you determined who you were through your actions, and that sticks. The actions still happen as long as somebody remembers them, or the effect lasts somewhere.
Back to that farmer. If he had lost his memory in between the sowing and the harvesting, he would still be able to harvest the various vegetables and fruits.
Yes, yes, he would not remember he was a farmer, but the fruits of his labor, quite literally in this case, would still exist.
Mm. And he would still be able to benefit from these fruits. I think that it is difficult to rely on your consciousness. As you grow older, particularly, you find that various aspects of the consciousness deteriorate, but these habits that are formed remain. They are extremely durable, and I often have wondered if these are the durable aspects of a spirit, these habits that are formed. And I urge anyone who is still of sound mind to determine which habits they would like to keep with them when their mind is gone.
This draws to me an interesting parallel. I think that we can all agree that if you have perhaps a good deed, an act of kindness, which you may perform without the observation of some external people, is it a good deed or not? And I think that most people would agree that if you may help be of benefit to others, it is a good thing to do, regardless of if there is any potential for recognition in the fact. Correct?
Yes.
So there is sort of a parallel with the identity. These habits you have, these effects you have in the world, they are there whether or not there is a recognition of them explicitly within your memory.
What I find many times in the clinical research nature of my work with potions, when I see people who come to me and they're looking for a potion to help them lower the wall that separates their spirit from the world. Something to lower inhibitions and help them connect. And as we discuss identity and interaction, I think that this possibly can shed some light on our discussion, because there are many people who I've met, some are friends, some are just acquaintances, who lock themselves away from the world. They are afraid to do certain things because they are afraid of being judged. They have a fear of not living up to certain standards. We all know people who share these traits, and it locks off their personality from the world. And because of that, they have trouble forming an identity. So I really believe that in order to truly know who you are, you have to be part of the world. You cannot lock yourself away from it.
That is quite an interesting observation, and I think that it sheds some light on the nature of identity. To say that what is an apple in a universe which contains nothing but the apple? I mean, there is nothing there. It is just itself.
Mm. At the same time, I think that a student of modern science may be tempted to define an identity as a collection of particles. And yet it's so clear that periodically, as one consumes and excretes and builds and destroys, that I may carry very little of the same material that I was born with. And yet, like the ship, I remain the same person in some sense. We would not argue that because my arms had been replaced one by one, and likewise my brain, that I was suddenly, I had become another person, that my identity had been lost.
Yes, and I think it is precisely because we are coming to the conclusion that the identity is really within the patterns of interaction that exist between one identity and another. The identity is to give a meaning to one end of the interaction.
It has been very quiet on the lines lately. I believe it's possibly a good time to announce that if you would like to share your identity with us and interact with the show, that the number is 617-253-8810, and we have two lines open. We all know about this, or we have all heard, at the very least, about this theory in science that things like light can be both particle and wave, and I'm trying to relate that back to our concept of the person and the identity and what life is, and perhaps that is how we must view life. We are not just individual particles of light, we are of life. We are instead, while being individual life, we are also a giant wave of life. as well, both at the same time.
Why don't we bring a call in? That mysterious tone, which is both a caller and the absence of a caller.
At the same time.
No, this is quite interesting of a point of view. I think that it is quite clear. In fact, when we look at perhaps the ocean or the river, we may see upon it certain patterns, certain waves that exist. And the whole of the object is just water. But out of the patterns of interaction, we may pick out a particular wavefront, a particular shape, and watch it as it travels and assign identity upon this traveling piece, which is not different from the whole, but distinguishable.
Like the individual crest in the wave, we travel our own path. Yet without the rest of the wave, we would be undefined and meaningless without purpose.
I love the image of the wave, like one sitting in a pool of water, again, with or without memory, if you send a ripple on the water. You will be slapped by the water in response. Should we try to bring that caller in again? Caller, marhaban.
Hi, my name's Bridget Connolly, and I was wondering if you could talk more about what part of the wave really is the person and so on.
Well, I wonder, caller, if you have any views on the matter. Because my view, personally, is that you can't really determine what part of the wave is any one person. That is the paradox of the issue. Can you really, when you get down to it spiritually, tell the difference between any of us? Are not all of our souls intertwined
and,
in the matrix of life?
If I might add to that, I think that as you watch the patterns of waves, there will be many peaks, and they will combine and they will split, and their numbers will change over time. And so it is not that identity is a thing which exists forever. It is temporary. The things which make up me after I am gone, it may not be simple to call them part of me. Afterwards, I will break up, there will be all sorts of bacteria and these things which will eat me, and in the end of the day, identity is something that makes sense as it can be defined, but after that, it is not a good concept for me.
Well, to me, this idea of being a particle or a wave, it makes me believe that we don't say that there is a duality of existence directly, simply that a person has properties that are reminiscent of what we would associate with a particle, single being, unaffected by other things, colliding with things, and simultaneously have aspects which are wave-like, that there are the possibilities of one soul passing through another person, or that that one may become flipped when they run into a wall. These are wave-like properties.
The complex and elaborate interactions we engage with each other on a daily basis, how can you possibly think of one life as an isolated island particle, if you will? In certain aspects it works, and in others it doesn't. I really think you need both views.
Yes, I think it is quite poignant, this point of view in which we consider the ocean and the waves upon it and the way in which they merge and they flow, come apart, come together. And the association thereof with some identity, with some label.
And I think we all know, or at least have intuitive experience, that human spirits can indeed diffract like a wave.
Mm.
We come upon some barrier, some obstacle in our life, and we don't just go straight through it unscathed. We come out on the other side. The barrier interferes with us intrinsically and changes our path. It changes who we are, where we're going, almost to the point that we can't even determine where we came from, just like the proverbial photon going through the slit.
Mm. And this is important because, once again, it is difficult to rely on our memory. The memory itself is not enough to determine identity.
Yes, for that would be assuming that life was isolated and individual, which I believe we have come to the conclusion that you can't just think of it in that way.
Yes, I am considering the absurd possibility to stand on the beach and to name the waves as they come after you. And you will find, I think, that it does not make sense, because by the time which you have thought of a name which you will give to any given wave, it will disappear so quickly, and then you must find another name for the next wave, and so on and so forth. It is like to say that to look at a person from the perspective of many hundreds or many thousands of years, you will not find that it is too important to give him one identity, but perhaps instead to look at the patterns which come out of the people during this kind of time. So I think that in this sense, identity is not something which we may say has an effect long after we have vanished.
For a second, I thought we may have vanished, but it was a premature fear. We are all still here.
But perhaps I felt it too. I think there was some ethereal conversion for a moment.
I wonder if we took the hypothetical situation where we have one man in a room devoid of anything else, a black room, complete and utter sensory deprivation. He can hear nothing, he can see nothing, he can taste nothing or feel nothing. Does he have an identity? I would say no.
Well, I think that the question depends upon the history of the man. We know that it is possible to use these sensory deprivation experiences, but they are temporary. And I am told, although I am not personally versed in the matter, that if you do this, then you will experience hallucinations and these sort of things. You're reminiscent of dreams, but perhaps they seem very, very physical. And it seems to me impossible to have these derived on anything but that which is remembered within the mind. So even though the hallucinations are not in themselves a direct memory, they are the products of the things which the man knows and has experienced. They are made of the constructs which make the memories. And so if you want to know if a man in a universe by himself has an identity, I think it depends if He has always been in a universe by himself with no perception of anything. Is there really a man?
Well, sorry to cut close the discussion, but unfortunately we are nearing the end of time, and I wish to make a few announcements that are of a timely nature. So recently, since the last program, the Dalai Lama has retired from ruling the political nation to begin ruling the spiritual one. This is the first announcement. The second is that a man was able to measure this week the mass of the soul, but there was a substantial experimental error, so it's still unknown. Third is that apparently there was a cat that was given a key to eternal happiness, but unfortunately is unable to communicate it. And finally, I want everyone to know that your soul is everywhere and you will live forever, but your body will disappear and you won't know that you're still alive.
Well, thank you for that. It is interesting, very peaceful, I think, when I contemplate it. I hope that it has a similar effect for everyone else out there.
I am confused, but as we've hit another barrier to diffract through, I believe I will save it for another time.
Well, thank you for both for joining me this evening. Thank you, Erno.
Thank you, Doctor. Have a good weekend.
And thanks to you, Zoro.
Thank you, Doctor, and as always, thank you to all the listeners out there.
I am Dr. Jalis Sakran here on Music for Human. Music for Human is New Age Talk Radio with an emphasis on you. We are here every Friday at 7 p.m. on WMBR Cambridge. Stay tuned for Terra Voice. Ma'asrami.
For safety.
Number one.
Cars and bikes stop at red lights.
It's against the law for car drivers or bicycle riders to ignore traffic signals.
So don't buzz through red lights. There might be a pedestrian or turning car that doesn't see you coming.
Number two.
Look first before you open your door.
Numerous bicyclists have been injured or even killed by car doors suddenly opening into them.
Look first, and bicyclists, stay out of the door zone.
Number three.
Cross with the signal.
You are safest if you wait for a walk or green traffic signal.
Don't jaywalk. That's just walking into trouble.
Number four.
Cars and bikes should stop for pedestrians and unsignalized crosswalks.
Be nice. Be legal. Be safe.
Brought to you as a public service by the Cambridge Bicycle Committee and this station.
The views and opinions presented on this program do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of WMBR, the Technology Broadcasting Corporation, or MIT. This is Terror Boys. WMBR, Cambridge, 88.1 FM.
Greetings, planet Earth.
And actually, greetings to any other planets that might have developed superb radio signal picking up technology. We don't discriminate here. But good evening, Cambridge and Boston. Thank you for joining us tonight. Last week, we promised an insider's look at the Masdar Institute of Technology, but unfortunately, my co-host Allison was abducted by a band of cheetahs. It was really awful. They thought that she was their queen. That isn't really like them. They're usually loners. I mean, I don't know, maybe a biochemistry experiment went wrong. They also don't live around here.
Anyways, actually, so instead you get your old friendly host back. But we didn't want to cover the Masdar sound without our expert Allison. So we're creating some quality dramatic suspense here by making you wait. And actually, some more exciting news, you will indeed be waiting because for the next 2 weeks,